Hello, everyone. You are listening to Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouement, on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. And have I got a story for you today? Today, we're taking a look back on the first season of The Mandalorian. It is a series that is also marketed as Star Wars The Mandalorian in places outside of U.S. territories. But it is an American space western streaming television series that was created by Jon Favreau and released on Disney Plus back in 2019. It is the first live-action series set within the Star Wars franchise, and it takes place about 5 years after the events of Return of the Jedi, the original conclusion to the original trilogy of Star Wars films that started it all. The series itself follows the title character, a Mandalorian bounty hunter named Din Djarin, and his exploits beyond the reaches of the New Republic. Favreau also serves as head writer and showrunner, as well as executive producer alongside other Star Wars alumni and creators, Dave Filoni, Kathleen Kennedy, and Colin Wilson. The Mandalorian first premiered with the launch of Disney Plus on November 12, 2019, with the first season running for about 8 episodes until December 27, 2019. The series has received positive reviews from critics, earning praise for its acting, directing, writing, musical score, and visual effects, although it received some criticism for its pacing, which is pretty understandable since it is a tightly knit show, just running for about 8 episodes. It was nominated for Outstanding Drama Series at the 72nd Primetime Emmy Awards, along with winning 7 Primetime Creative Arts Emmy Awards from even just 14 nominations. Now, I am choosing to talk about this show today in preparation for the second season, which is also consisting of 8 episodes and is scheduled to premiere on the same streaming service of Disney Plus on October 30th, 2020. On this show, we will be discussing the plot summaries, production background, character arcs, production techniques, and what aspiring writers and storytellers can learn from everything and anything related to television and films. So if you would like to avoid spoilers on the amazing and astounding story of The Mandalorian, specifically the first season, please tune out now, because I believe that anyone new to Star Wars or to The Mandalorian should at least experience this story without any spoilers. Now, before we get into the production background and techniques, as well as the character arcs and what aspiring storytellers and writers can learn from this show, I would like to cover the main events of The Mandalorian Season 1. Specifically, the story of Din Djarin, also known as the titular Mandalorian. Now, the Mandalorian's backstory is elaborated upon through various flashbacks. And the Mandalorian's real name is Din Djarin, though that is not revealed until Chapter 8, Redemption, the first season finale of The Mandalorian. Aspects of the character's backstory are provided gradually, and as a child, his parents are killed during an attack by battle droids affiliated with the Separatist Alliance during the Clone Wars. Multiple civilians are killed during the attack, and Din's parents hide him just before dying in an explosion. Din himself is rescued by a tribe of Mandalorian warriors, and he is later adopted into their culture as a foundling, an orphan raised in the Mandalorian tradition despite not coming from the planet of Mandalore. He joins a tribe led by the Armorer, and the clan is forced into hiding due to persecution at the hands of the Galactic Empire. Now, a little bit more about the Mandalorian, and specifically his clan of Mandalorians. The Mandalorian never removes his helmet in front of others, which his tribe would consider a betrayal worthy of expulsion. Other characters from different Mandalorian tribes in other Star Wars works, however, have been depicted as able to remove their helmets without it affecting their status. The Mandalorian eventually becomes a bounty hunter and joins the Bounty Hunters Guild and becomes widely known by the nickname Mando, which also refers to the generic term of Mandalorian known throughout the Star Wars universe. At some point prior to the events of The Mandalorian, he works with a group of mercenaries that include Rand Malk, Xeon, and Quint. He eventually splits from the group under non-amicable circumstances, for which they blame him. The Mandalorian also pilots a gunship called the Razor Crest, and one of his primary weapons is an Ambin sniper rifle, which has a prong-shaped barrel that fires bursts powerful enough to disintegrate any of its targets. Fun fact, the weapon was actually inspired by a similar rifle used by the bounty hunter Boba Fett in the Star Wars Holiday Special of 1978. But again, the events of The Mandalorian begin about 5 years after the conclusion of the original trilogy in the film Return of the Jedi. In the series premiere, The Mandalorian accepts a commission from Bounty Hunters Guild leader Greef Karga to collect a 50-year-old asset for a mysterious unnamed client who represents a remnant of the now-fallen Galactic Empire. The Mandalorian tracks the asset to Arvala 7, where he is aided by the Ugnaught farmer, Quill. After reluctantly partnering with the bounty hunter IG-11, the Mandalorian discovers that the asset is an infant from Yoda's species, known as the Child. In Chapter 2, The Child, the Mandalorian is nearly killed by a large mudhorn creature, but the Child uses the Force to help the Mandalorian to kill it. The Mandalorian successfully delivers the child to the client on the planet Navarro in Chapter 3, The Sin. Later, the Mandalorian has an uncharacteristic change of heart and returns to the client's base to rescue the child. On the way back to the Razor Crest, the Mandalorian is ambushed by Greef and other guild members, but he is able to escape Navarro after receiving aid from other Mandalorians from his tribe. While hiding from bounty hunters seeking him and the child, the Mandalorian takes several missions to make ends meet. They include protecting a Sorgan village from raiders in Chapter 4 Sanctuary, capturing the assassin Fennec Shand on Tatooine in Chapter 5 The Gunslinger, and a prison raid with Rand Malk's mercenaries in Chapter 6 The Prisoner. In the penultimate first season episode, Greef contacts the Mandalorian and says the client's troops have overrun his town. Greef promises to cancel the bounty on the Mandalorian if he helps eliminate the client. The Mandalorian then recruits several allies for the mission, including Quill, the now repaired IG-11, and ex-Rebel shock trooper Cara Dune, who he earlier encountered on Sorgan. However, when they confront the client on Navarro, they are ambushed by Moff Gideon and his Death Trooper-led regiment, who kill the client and trap the Mandalorian's allies. Gideon reveals secret details about each of them, including the Mandalorian's birth name, Din Djarin, confirming that Gideon was involved in a past assault against the Mandalorians known as the Purge of Mandalore. Quill is killed, and the Mandalorian is severely injured during a gunfight with Gideon's forces in the season finale. IG-11 briefly removes the Mandalorian's helmet to tend to his wounds, revealing his face for the first time in the show. He does this through the loophole that IG-11 is not really a living being, but in fact a robotic droid. The Mandalorian and his allies then seek help from the Mandalorian's tribe, only to find Imperials have wiped out his covert. They find the tribe's leader, the Armorer, who formally adopts the child into the Mandalorian culture as a foundling, just like Mando. She instructs the Mandalorian to seek out and deliver the child to the others of his kind, and says the Mandalorian will be like a father to him. IG-11 sacrifices himself to help the others escape, and the Mandalorian fends off a final attack by Gideon before departing from Navarro. Now, that was just the plot of The Mandalorian Season 1. Tune into our next segment when I will be discussing the production background and techniques used to bring this incredible world of The Mandalorian and Star Wars to life. You have been listening to Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouement on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. Hello, everyone. We are back on Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouement on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. So far today, we have been looking back on The Mandalorian, specifically the first season of what's also known as Star Wars The Mandalorian, which is an American space western streaming television series that was created by Jon Favreau and released on Disney Plus in the year of 2019. It is also the first live-action series set within the Star Wars franchise. And since I've already covered the major plot summary of season one and the overall events of the main character, the Mandalorian, within that storyline, I would now like to talk a little bit more about the production history and background of The Mandalorian as a TV series. Now, The Mandalorian was at first a secret television project for Lucasfilm that was being touched upon by Jon Favreau back when he was directing the photorealistic remake of The Lion King for Walt Disney Pictures. Kathleen Kennedy first heard of this during that summer of him directing the film and put him in touch with other acclaimed Star Wars creator and crafter, Dave Filoni, and when the two men met, Filoni began to draw doodles on napkins of what would become the child, or Baby Yoda. And after each day of work on the Lion King's virtual reality set in Playa Vista, Favreau would then stay late and work a few more hours developing his secret television project for Lucasfilm. It was eventually revealed on March 8, 2018, that Favreau was the writer and executive producer of the forthcoming Star Wars television series that was yet to be named. In May 2018, Favreau stated that half of the scripts for the first season had been completed, and then on October 3rd, Favreau announced that the series had been titled The Mandalorian and revealed the show's central premise. The following day, it was revealed that additional executive producers would include Dave Filoni, Kathleen Kennedy, and Colin Wilson, with Karen Gilchrist serving as a co-executive producer. Filoni was also expected to direct the series' first episode in his live-action directorial debut, with additional directors including Taika Waititi, Bryce Dallas Howard, Rick Famuyiwa, and Deborah Chow. The first season cost approximately $100 million to make. Regarding casting, by November 2018, it was revealed that Pedro Pascal would play the Mandalorian, Gina Carano would play an ex-Rebel shock trooper by the name of Cara Dune, and Nick Nolte would play the voice of farm worker / ex-Imperial slave worker. After meeting with Favreau, Pascal had actually thought that he would be playing Boba Fett, but he indeed plays a separate Mandalorian by the name of Din Djarin. On December 12, 2018, Lucasfilm announced that Giancarlo Esposito, Carl Weathers, Emily Swallow, Omid Abtahi, and Werner Herzog had also joined the main cast, with Taika Waititi joining later on as the voice of the character known as IG-11, the bounty hunter droid. Ming-Na Wen was also revealed to have a role within The Mandalorian late in August. Principal photography for the first season began during the first week of October 2018 in Southern California, under the working title Huckleberry. George Lucas visited the series set as a birthday surprise for Favreau on October 19th. It was later revealed that the Star Wars creator had some level of involvement in creating the show as well. And when Pascal would eventually become unavailable for filming, the Mandalorian would occasionally be portrayed physically by stunt actors Brendan Wayne and Latif Crowder, with Wayne having worked closely with Pascal to help develop his character. Filming for the first season then wrapped on February 27, 2019. Now, regarding the episodes, Dave Filoni, Taika Waititi, Bryce Dallas Howard, Rick Famuyiwa, and Deborah Chow served as the main directors for the overall season. Favreau was also unable to direct any of the first season due to his commitments to The Lion King, and wanted the series directors to be a diverse group of filmmakers who could bring different perspectives to the series. The only prerequisite he had for the directors was apparently that they loved Star Wars. According to Famuyiwa himself, Favreau described the group as a Dirty Dozen, Magnificent Seven type of crew, in reference to the Dirty Dozen and Magnificent Seven Western films. Filoni made his live-action directorial debut with the series, and he saw The Mandalorian as a chance to apply lessons he had learned from Lucasfilm about live-action filmmaking during the making of the Star Wars animated series, and also described Favreau as a sort of mentor who was furthering Filoni's education and could help him overcome challenges specific to live-action. Filoni also served as a second-unit director for the other filmmakers, filming quick pickup shots for them as needed while they were busy on other scenes. Favreau also noted that the fourth episode of the series, Sanctuary, was the most difficult to make due to its forest setting and action requirements, and joked that this was the reason that Howard, the most inexperienced of the first season's directors, was given that episode to direct. Howard felt protected by the experience of Favreau and Filoni, feeling comfortable enough to go to them with any questions about filmmaking and Star Wars respectively. And she also felt that she had creative control and freedom when directing the episode, which was something that her father, Ron Howard, who directed the film Solo, A Star Wars Story, also mentioned later on. The series itself is filmed on a large soundstage with a 360-degree LED video wall at Manhattan Beach Studios, supplemented by limited location shooting around Southern California. It was later revealed that the video wall was actually built to form a 270-degree volume, nicknamed The Volume, with optional panels that could be dropped in when needed for 360-degree coverage. The series sent camera crews to shoot distant locations like Iceland and Chile, and the resulting digital assets were integrated into virtual sets built with the Unreal game engine from Epic Games, and those sets were displayed on the then video wall of The Volume. In Favreau's own words, "So, there is real photography being incorporated, but the actors aren't brought on location. The location is brought to the actors." What made the series' virtual sets appear so immersive, as opposed to flat images on a video wall, was the ability of the Unreal Engine to accurately simulate parallax in real time based on where the camera was currently pointed. And parallax is a displacement or difference in the apparent position of an object viewed along two different lines of sight, and is then measured by the angle or semi-angle of inclination between those said two lines. To do that, small motion capture cameras were mounted on top of the video wall to watch for infrared markers on the main camera, and in turn, the motion capture cameras had to be digitally removed in post-production. Once the Unreal Engine knew the exact location and angle of the camera, it could update parallax within a small patch of the video wall currently visible to the camera. So, like I said, this series used a gigantic dome of a video wall to help film certain locations and certain settings set within the Star Wars universe of this series. And to accomplish all of this, the Unreal game engine from Epic Games was used, which I think is a very unreal feat to achieve, because Unreal game engine is a specific engine that is used for creating video games, and mind you, very stellar video games in the realm of photorealistic or even motion capture video games. The game engine has actually been used for various famous video games like Mortal Kombat and Injustice, as well as Batman, the Arkham series, and tons of other great video games. The visual effects were produced by the original Star Wars producer Industrial Light and Magic, which is a subsidiary of Lucasfilm, and it actually opened a new division in November 2018 targeted for streaming and episodic television called ILM TV. Based in London, with support from the company's locations in San Francisco, Vancouver, and Singapore, it is expected that this new division will actually work extensively on live-action Star Wars television series starting with The Mandalorian. Regarding music, On December 19th, 2018, it was announced that acclaimed composer Ludwig Göransson would compose the musical score for the series. Each chapter actually has its own soundtrack album, which is released or was released on the same day of every single episode. And for the score, Göransson played many of the key instruments himself, and then added a 70-piece orchestra afterward. He wrote about 4 hours of music for all 8 episodes. The music for this series is unreal considering what we've gotten in the past with Star Wars. And I have to personally say that this has been one of my favorite soundtracks of anything ever. Now, tune in to our next segment where I will be discussing the overall character arc of The Mandalorian, the titular character of The Mandalorian TV series, and eventually what writers and storytellers can learn from The Mandalorian as a television series. You have been listening to Have I Got a Story for You with your host DJ Daniel Mon on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. Hello everyone. We are back on Have I Got a Story for You with your host DJ Daniel Mon on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. And so far we have been looking back on The Mandalorian, the first season of the series, as well as the plot summary of the overall storyline of this first season, and the production background and history behind creating this wonderful new realm of Star Wars set within the Star Wars franchise. Now I'd like to cover a little bit more about The Mandalorian as a character and his arc seen throughout season one, and analyze some of the themes seen throughout this first season and his story. Now, at the start of the series, there is a real sense of ambiguity throughout the atmosphere of the Mandalorian as a character. We, the audience, don't really know too much about him other than maybe his name, although the Mandalorian does have a full clan of other Mandalorian warriors. So it does make it kind of difficult to know what exactly to call him by the start of this series. But what does the Mandalorian do? The Mandalorian is a lone gunfighter and bounty hunter of the Outer Rim or near edge of the universe. And what does the Mandalorian want? Well, the Mandalorian, sometimes referred to as Mando, is a generic term used to refer to all Mandalorians and a clan of skilled warriors. The Mandalorian, or Mando, wants to continue to uphold his clan's creed of never taking his helmet off in the presence of another living being, while also keeping with his somewhat consistent and honorable lifestyle of bounty hunting. In just the first 10 minutes of the overall series, we the audience learn that our main Mandalorian warrior is a battle-hardened bounty hunter. And what is supposed to be a full silver set of armor is now mostly rickety and rusted. Backing this battle-hardened exterior are brief moments of Mando's bravado, which shows through a quiet confidence that also brings about a sort of grace and gravitas that is even conveyed through some witty one-liners every now and then. In short, Mando collects bounties, and it's usually up to his targets whether he brings them in warm or brings them in cold. But what happens when one of Mando's targets cannot even make that choice? Mando himself belongs to a system of bounty hunters known as the Guild. This collective force is his primary economy. It is what he has made his living off of, for years in fact. And we can even see that this chosen profession is what brings him a sense of comfort and consistency, especially to those like Mando, who are living in a time of further change, what with the end of the Empire and rise of the New Republic. But this same system is then disrupted when Mando meets the child, or as he has now been dubbed by fans, Baby Yoda. The first episode or chapter of the series progresses almost like any other bounty for Mando. Well, except for the fact that his latest job has come from some of the worst marksmen in cinematic history and the very enemy of his people, the Imperial Empire, or what's left of it anyways. But like I said, Mando is treating this job mostly like any other until he meets the child, until he meets what he used to be, an orphan. That is when he makes the choice that the child cannot yet make. He saves him, shooting IG-11, the bounty hunter droid that assisted him and that he ran into on the job in the process. But it is not until after some assistance from the now-free Ugnaught, Quill, and directly handing off the child to the Empire's remnants, that Mando must make another choice about the child's fate, a choice that goes against the guild and the assumed nature of Mandalorian bounty hunters about them always getting the job done with no attachment or emotion whatsoever. A choice that sustains the new sheen of Mando's newly restored Beskar armor. Yet, in going against the guild, against the old guard of the Empire, and overall old ways, so does the rest of his Mandalorian clan. What was left of the Mandalorians after the Empire's rule is now no longer in hiding and ready to embrace Mando as one of them, as one of their most honorable warriors for this reason. The Mandalorian, as not just a show, but as a character, deals with themes of nature and nurture. Not much is known about the character of the Mandalorian by others or even the audience for that matter. It is not until some flashbacks during the lead-up to Mando's rescue of the child from the Imperial forces on Navarro and the guild that he was a foundling, an orphan, from during a droid attack of the Clone Wars era, and that he was rescued by Mandalorian warriors and eventually raised within his current clan and creed of Mandalorians. That is why he has chosen to save the child, because he not only sees a new blank slate of life, but he sees himself as well. After temporarily escaping the Empire and Guild, Mando and the child temporarily go on a couple of adventures within the universe. And through these adventures, we the audience, including Mando, this time around, come to learn a lot more about our main Mandalorian warrior and his nature. From Chapter 4, Sanctuary, we learn of the main temptation behind our lone battle-hardened warrior. A peaceful and quiet life, possibly surrounded by family, while surrounded by nature itself. Fitting, right? It is here that Mando encounters the forest planet of Sorgan, where it is far from any established government or rule. Far yet full of mostly untamed farmlands, and even freer people. Freer people that, with rewarding help from those like Mando, can also stay that way. It is here that Mando claims the child can be free to thrive. But like the widowed mother Omera states, it is a place that Mando can be free to thrive off of as well. And he actually comes really close to leaving his clan and current mission when Omera also tries to take off his helmet. Until they are interrupted by the one of many guild hunters that have the means of tracking the child. And so, for his future on the forested and free world of Sorgan with the peaceful people of Omera's village, it is not meant to be. On their next adventure in Chapter 5, The Gunslinger, Mando and the child encounter a rookie guild member who is looking to claim the fame and fortune of a lone bounty hunter. Throughout this episode, we see what Mando could have easily become if he were not part of his Mandalorian clan, if he were instead raised without honor. Toro Calican is the bumbling and self-proclaimed gunslinger of this episode, and is also the juxtaposition to Mando's character within the overall story, which is fitting since Calican does not live long after he chooses to double-cross our titular hero. With the last episode before the first season's two-part finale, Chapter 6, The Prisoner, we see one of the many parts of Mando's nature. We see how he rose above the ranks of those like Toro Calican and who he has to thank for it. We see some of the old partners and crew Mando used to work with, who are now all mostly conniving and double-crossing murderers who choose to stay within their old ways. In order to make more money to use to continue to evade the Empire and guild hunters, Mando has to team up with these former allies and rivals from his fledgling hunter past and rescue one of their own from imprisonment. But again, It turns out to be another double cross, and Mando has to clean up another mess by conniving assassins. Though this time around, he takes the high ground, and instead of killing his former allies turned foes, he imprisons them within the New Republic government. Before the epic finale of the first season of The Mandalorian, our main hero has not only effectively confronted three different threats, but three different aspects of his nature. He has found and confronted his desires, and found and confronted two sides of the same coin, the coin of what he could have become, a dishonorable warrior that would either face death or imprisonment. Mando has confronted these aspects of his nature as both preparation and tests for what comes next, a possible ending to his current mission of protecting the child. Because of Greef Karga's proposal for a way to mutually settle his and Mando's differences over the bounty of the child, Mando must seek allies from his recent adventures. He recruits the ever-reluctant ex-Rebel shock trooper Cara Dune and the ex-Imperial slave worker Queel, and Cara Dune is a sort of kindred spirit to Mando. She is just as battle-hardened, having fought in the same galactic war that claimed her birth world of Alderaan. And Queel serves as a kind of mentor to Mando. So far within the story, Queel has trained him in riding blurgs across great terrains and even schooled him on some knowledge of the child's force powers. Yet, overall, aside from the main antagonist of Moff Gideon and his Empire Armada, there is a fixed line of juxtaposition in terms of the natures of our main cast. Cara Dune and Queel have seemingly fixed natures of selfless sacrifice and serving for the greater good. Even Greef Karga falls within this category after his decision not to double-cross Mando out of gratefulness to the child's healing abilities. But Mando, the child, and even IG-11 serve as more ambiguous reflections of the same mirror. The show's crafters purposefully make Mando's morals ambiguous from the very start, while the child's morals are shown to be in flux since he is just a child. He is just a blank slate of life. And IG-11 is different from the rest in that he has programmable morals, and he is at first manufactured and programmed to be an attachmentless machine meant for dealing death, until he is eventually destroyed by Mando for that same purpose and rebuilt with Queel's caretaker craftsmanship. And he is built not to just destroy, but with the also implemented nature of nursing and protecting, of nurturing and protecting. Everything about IG-11's story serves as the main turnaround for Mando. IG's turn from merciless killer to watchful protector helps prove to Mando, who hates droids for taking away his family, that all life, either nurtured or programmed, is important, and that life can be both just that, natured and nurtured. But overall, the cast of The Mandalorian goes through the same change. The change of going against your assumed nature by others, and instead embracing the true morals and nature of yourself. Tune into our next segment, where I'll be discussing the main aspects of storytelling that writers can learn from within The Mandalorian as a television series. You have been listening to Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouman, on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. Hello, everyone. We are back on Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouman, on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. So far, we have been taking a look back on The Mandalorian, and specifically the first season's plot summaries, as well as the production background and character arcs. Now I'd like to talk a little bit more about what aspiring storytellers and writers can learn from The Mandalorian, as not just a TV series, but as an extension of a long-standing legacy of a gigantic media franchise. Star Wars has been around for more than 40 years. How crazy to think about is that? It is a media franchise that took almost the entire world by storm in the late 1970s and has even continued to persist within popular culture everywhere. I remember the first time I was ever introduced to Star Wars. My father was and is still a huge fan of the space opera. One of his favorite characters of anything ever is Darth Vader. And how I know this is because he literally keeps a framed holographic picture of him on his wall within his work office. Okay, I'm kind of straying. But that's the exact point I'm trying to make. That story about my love of Star Wars coming from my own father's love of Star Wars carries the exact same pattern that The Mandalorian and other Star Wars media has embraced. The pattern and art of straying and staying. The Mandalorian as a show contains characteristics that are familiar to other Star Wars properties. There are spaceships and space battles, there are laser blasters and lightsabers, there are numerous alien species of all ages and sizes, and multiple bounty hunters of all kinds of backgrounds. Even the Force is there. But after watching the first season for the first time, I could tell that what makes The Mandalorian so special is that it is also different. It has a different flavor than other properties and entries seen within this galactic saga. And it's because of literally everything about the show. On technical levels, since the show was made more than 40 years since the first Star Wars film, it can take more creative liberties than any of its other predecessors. And it has. Sure, the original trilogy of films carried both computer-generated and practical effects really well for its time thanks to ILM, thanks to Industrial Light and Magic, but so has this web television series. Jon Favreau and some of the other craftsmen from past projects like the Iron Man, live-action Jungle Book, and live-action Lion King films brought their own experiences and creative energies to this space western of a show. They and other new creators of the Star Wars franchise brought the same level of ingenuity that the original Star Wars films have. And it was because of creative freedom. Creative freedom and control is important within any kind of project. And when anything, I mean anything, from live performances to photo or videographic films to novels or novellas, has creative freedom to bring a certain vision to life, then in most respects, that piece of creative media will succeed in at least one respect. But another thing that aspiring storytellers should learn is how to generate genre. Here is a fact, and I mean a genuine fact about Star Wars. It is made up of and has many things going for it. Now that sounds pretty bland in general to say, but it has war on an extremely epic scale. It has wizards and witches that duel in swords and sorcery. It has bars and saloons full of bounty hunters and smugglers. It has anything and everything going for it. Star Wars is a saga of various genres. Did you know that if you Google Star Wars on the internet and look for descriptions on what it is, that it will tell you it's either an epic space opera or space western? These should be two different conflicting genre descriptions, but they're not, because they're true. It is true that Star Wars is made up of multiple genres. In fact, I think it is the very essence of science fiction and fantasy combined, and one of the few true titles that has a right to be on any streaming services categories for that classification. But again, I'm straying. Or am I? Can one even stray within the realm of Star Wars? Because if you take a look back at every single piece of media within any and all eras of Star Wars, then you would see that no matter the difference of quality or time, each piece is undeniably Star Wars. Like the many flavors of M&M's and Skittles candies, there are many flavors or genres of Star Wars. Other than the main entries and The Mandalorian, here's an example of another genre-bending entry within the franchise. My favorite piece of Star Wars-related media is known as Star Wars Clone Wars, And no, I don't mean The Clone Wars, the 2009 3D animated series that is also great. I mean the 2D one. The one that was created by the amazing creator of Dexter's Laboratory, Samurai Jack, and the currently running Primal. It was created by Genndy Tartakovsky. Star Wars Clone Wars was an animated television micro-series meant to produce and sell toys of classic and new elements of Star Wars. They were a bunch of mini micro-episodes seen within the cartoon channel of Cartoon Network that were just that. They were meant to be promotions and ads for these toys, these figurines. But it eventually grew into something more. It became something more in the sense of its storytelling. It was a brilliantly animated series with enough bombastic war action and the quiet stillness of samurai-like sword fights between the Jedi and the Sith to hold its own within the franchise and realm of Star Wars. Despite it not being canon to this day, it still holds up and is a definite recommendation if you're into anything related to whatever I just talked about and related to anything Star Wars. And like Star Wars Clone Wars, The Mandalorian succeeds as a series due to its creative freedom and not just the control of it, but the expansion of one of many genres within the Star Wars universe. It is an extended part of a long-standing legacy that involves over 40 years of filmmaking and craftsmanship for a specific franchise, for Star Wars. And everything from the creative liberties taken in the production, as well as the change in the, or more like the subtle change of the musical elements and motifs, everything about it is screaming expansion for the franchise. Even though there are familiar elements and characteristics seen throughout Star Wars and seen throughout everything, including The Mandalorian is still set apart by everything about it. What makes it so similar to the rest of Star Wars is also what makes it so different. But it is the good kind of different that helps draw in more audience members, that helps draw in more people instead of just delivering the same old thing of another galactic war or another kid from some desert farmland that wants to grow up to become a Jedi. This series is about a different type of character, different types of characters, a different type of story. And The Mandalorian also succeeds because it brings about a whole new side to the Star Wars canon, a side that has been rarely shown since the original film. It succeeds as the gunslinging and star-faring space western it was meant to be. And this aspect of Star Wars has been lost for some time, in my opinion, since the original film itself. Again, The Mandalorian succeeds as the space western it was meant to be. And when genre-bending stories like these are brought to life, then any creator can literally create anything. And when any show accomplishes this as successfully as The Mandalorian does, I guarantee that it will be a hit. This has been Have I Got a Story for You with your host, DJ Denouman, on Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, the official radio station at Dominican University of California. Thank you for listening.